prochain arrêt, c'est Terminus.
Hello and welcome to In Particular.
Tales from the Particle Frontier.
I'm Laura Gentil.
I'm Tova Holmes.
And I'm Zach Marshall.
And we're particle physicists here at CERN.
In this podcast, we'll explore physics and the process of discovering physics at the Large Hadron Collider.
We're coming to you from the ATLAS experiment, one of the particle detectors at the LHC.
On June 3rd, ATLAS saw its first collisions since early 2013. This marked the beginning of a new era for high-energy particle physics, but it was also the end of a two-year-long period of upgrades and improvements to our experiment.
In these last 2 years, the LHC was upgraded to produce more frequent, higher-energy collisions. On ATLAS, we spent these 2 years finishing analysis of the last run's data and preparing our experiment to handle the pending flood of collisions.
In this episode, we'll focus on that preparation, talking to a few people who were key players in several of the major upgrades.
What were some of the projects that had to be ready before the collisions?
And what challenges did these projects face as they worked to meet their deadlines?
My name is Katrin Bernius. I work for New York University, and for the last few years, I've been primarily working on the ATLAS trigger system, which basically decides whether certain data gets recorded or not.
40 million times a second in the ATLAS detector, there are 20 simultaneous proton-proton collisions. It would be 60 terabytes of data every second if we tried to write out every collision. We would write out as much information as is on the entire internet every year.
The first level of the trigger looks at a very coarse-grained picture of the event and has about 1 microsecond to decide whether or not it wants to retrieve the full fine-grained picture of the event from the detector.
And in the second decision, it has about 1 second to figure out whether the event is interesting enough to be written to tape and stored, or whether it will be lost.
It's a large part of the ATLAS detector. However, there are not that many people working on it. I would say around 100 or 200. Compared to the job the ATLAS trigger has to do, and compared to the size of the collaboration, I think we are quite limited in some areas, at least in manpower as well.
100 or 200 people might sound like a lot, but the 3,000 physicists on ATLAS rely on the trigger group to make the right decisions and keep the data that they need for their analyses.
All of the physics analysis we do depends absolutely on having recorded the events that are interesting. If we don't make a good decision when the protons are colliding about what we want to record, we can never recover collisions that may have had new physics in them. With the higher energy collisions and the more intense rate of collisions, there are more interesting events being produced more often. And for the trigger, that's a challenge because it means they need to upgrade the hardware, the software, and the algorithms in order to save the most interesting events.
I think I can fairly confidently say that we were expecting everything to run smoothly because we put in a lot of work over the last few months. I mean, the biggest day for us was the 3rd of June because everyone is watching and you have to perform well. The entire control room was filled up with people and cameras were there and all the media. While I pretty confidently say that we were expecting to run smoothly, it was still a bit of uncertainty, obviously, and there's certain factors you might not have thought of in that special moment. So there was a little bit of a tense atmosphere, but as soon as we switched to ATLAS Ready, then everything went fine and we could relax. I think in 2009 it was a slightly different situation because that was really the first time we turned on. Whereas now we were a little more familiar with the system, even though we have quite a few new parts, and there has been a lot of experience and expertise around from the early days of LHC running.
So everything went according to plan? There were no oddities?
No, I think everything went according to plan. We had to... Why are you looking like that?
It's so rare that something goes just according to plan. Everything's okay.
I'm just surprised.
Exactly.
So from the point of view of the trigger system, the first collisions were an enormous success. It worked as expected. Of course, as Catherine said, they didn't turn it on the day of the first collisions. They tested it for many, many months beforehand and worked out all of the delays and issues they had in advance so it was ready when it needed to be ready.
In fact, it had to be ready the first day of collisions to record all the data that were coming in. But we also needed it ready in advance so that we could test all of the other things that had to be ready on that first day. We talked to someone working on the software downstream of the trigger.
This may be a familiar voice for some of you who listened to our first episode.
My name is Christian Ohm. I'm a postdoc at Berkeley Lab. Right now, I spend the majority of my time trying to get the software ready to reconstruct the data that we're going to record and run to.
The reconstruction software finds patterns in the very low-level signals coming from the detector, the voltages and currents. It can interpret as particles going through the detector, and it can try and understand what was going on inside each event. There are different people in charge of different aspects of the reconstruction software. Some people working on understanding the signals from certain parts of the detector, and other people working on putting those detector parts together to get a more global view of what the event looked like.
And each of those teams might have tens of people working on the core software that's necessary to interpret these objects.
Making sure that the reconstruction software is ready and able to run on the data as it comes in is Christian's job. We sat down with Christian in the run-up to first collisions to see how things were going.
The preparations are going pretty well. We're moving quickly in the right direction, but there are a lot of problems to fix, and there are a lot of things that we haven't thought about since it's been so long since we last had data, and in particular, collision data.
So we don't want to make all of these changes and improvements to the detector and then just hope when we turn it on for the first time that everything works. So we actually spend a long time testing each improvement.
Over the last year, we had 9 coordinated week-long data-taking exercises where we tried to integrate the various parts of the detector together to make sure that the system would be ready for the first collisions.
There are also large changes that happen, sometimes a little bit too soon to these data-taking exercises. So one particularly memorable incident was that we tried to change from one database to another very shortly before having one of these data-taking exercises in these commissioning weeks. And that turned out to just delay all of the processing of the data that we were recording. And that in turn led to us not picking up problems with the data until the data-taking exercise was over.
But how does the debugging actually go in the end? Is it a bunch of people in a room somewhere? Is it one person with a laptop at 4 a.m.? What does it look like?
So both things happen, but definitely the latter is more descriptive and more common, I think. A lot of times what happens is that there's a set of very few experts that try to run the reconstruction of the data that we take. And then it's sort of a sequential bug finding exercise.
How many people are working on that with you?
That's a really good question. There are a lot of hands in, what's the expression in English? Hands in the pot? Too many hands on the gumbo is one expression. That's not what I want to say. Too many chefs?
Too many chefs in the kitchen.
But that's when you want to say that there are too many.
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to say that there are a lot of people involved, but not necessarily doing a lot of work. So a lot of times in our job, it's about producing results and providing tools that perform. But there are also important human aspects, I think, that you need to have some sense of who the developers are, what is their coding style, how do they react to pressure. And if you're in a position where you try to coordinate developers, you need to have some sense for this. So there have been examples where developers have been stressed too much and introduced a mistake. But there are also, of course, times where you have this bug report that's assigned to a specific person and you just send reminder after reminder after reminder. And this is, I think it helps a little bit being in the position that I am in to really be in charge of processing the data as it comes in, which is, of course, very urgent because everyone wants to look at the data quickly. And we also want to make sure before we get the collision data, we want to make sure that the detector works quickly. So it's really important that we do things urgently. And having the responsibility for that, I think, helps set the tone in these reminder messages to make things move along. But it's all, yeah, so sometimes it's kind of a, you don't feel like the nicest person sometimes, but when things have to happen, they have to happen.
We also asked Christian to talk about the results of some of the tests leading up to first collisions.
I really think that we should be able to reconstruct the data right as it comes in, and we can see the collisions and the particles being produced in the collisions within minutes after we've recorded them. And we have done a small-scale exercise of this, where the machine, so the accelerator shot the beams onto the collimators, which caused huge showers of particles hitting the detector and really everything just lighting up. And even this, we managed to reconstruct without any hiccups in the first pass, even though it took a bit to process all the data, of course. But it really ran without any problems. And this I was actually, to be honest, a little bit surprised by even. So this is probably the thing that I'm proudest of in this particular part of my job so far.
Anything else you want to tell us about the frenzy and the lead up to run two?
I need to sleep.
So there were upgrades to the trigger system, which had to be ready many months in advance. There were constant improvements to the software, which had to be ready at least a few weeks before each data-taking exercise. But in addition to lots of improvements to the existing systems in Atlas, we also developed an entirely new detector that was put in to the very center of Atlas. The timescale for designing, building, testing, and installing a detector is years, and it had to be ready many, many months before the possibility of collisions in the detector.
The detector's like a six-story building that's several thousands of tons, and you can't just open it and close it like a door. It takes months to move things out of the way with cranes to make sure that you can get at the center of the detector without hurting anything in the process.
So Katrin mentioned that for the trigger system, they benefited greatly from the experience of running the trigger in run one. But when you design and develop a new detector, you don't have that bank of experience. It's not something that you already know when you're trying to make improvements. It's an entirely new beast, and you have to learn its nature.
I'm Michael Kagan. I work for Slack. It's a laboratory connected with Stanford in Palo Alto. And I'm a postdoc on the Atlas experiment. As we start back up again in 2015, the intensity of the collisions and the energy of the collisions means that there's just a lot more particles coming out. And so we needed a new detector to be able to very precisely and very quickly measure all these different particles very accurately. At the same time, the detectors we already have, after many, many years of operation, they begin to get damaged, and so we needed another layer of detectors for ensuring the stability and the safe operation of the full system. In other words, it adds another layer of redundancy to the whole system.
In run one, the detector at the center of Atlas was the pixel detector. In run two, we've added a new detector, the IBL, to the center of the pixel detector.
The IBL stands for the insertable B layer. It's insertable because we can slide it into the rest of the system without taking everything apart. Although, funny story is we did end up taking everything apart. But in principle, we can slide it in without taking apart the rest of the detector. And it's called a B-layer because it's specifically designed for measuring the trajectories of particles that come from the decay of bottom quarks or B hadrons. So that's why it's called the B-layer. It's basically sitting directly on our beam pipe. The beam pipe is a little less than 3 centimeters in radius, and the IBL sits right just outside of the beam pipe. So it's about 3.5 centimeters from where the beam goes through the detector. The IBL is like a very fast camera for taking pictures of particles coming out of the collisions of the Large Hadron Collider. It's a camera in the sense that it has very, very small pixels. Those pixels are, 50 millionths of a meter by 250 millionths of a meter. So they're very, very tiny. And that allows us to basically know where a particle went within that distance scale. So we can very precisely measure where the particle went. There are these small, about 2 centimeter by 2 centimeter pieces of silicon. And those are our sensors. That's what actually detects the particles. And then we connect them, we bond them to a piece of front-end electronics. And those two pieces, the sensor and the electronics, they get placed onto a mechanical structure that holds them in place. And so every piece of that along the chain had to be built and tested and kind of qualified. Then they arrived at CERN. And at CERN, we had to do the final testing and calibration of them. And I was working on that piece.
How many people were involved in the whole project?
I believe it was about 40 institutions, amounting to probably a few hundred people.
Spread across the
world, really. So the pieces all kind of were assembled and sent to CERN starting around the summer of 2013. So it was actually quite a lot of fun. So one of the things you have to keep in mind about the pixel detectors is they have to be tested under somewhat strenuous conditions. And one of them is that they have to be operated very cold because they produce a lot of heat. So we built an environmental chamber that would keep it very dry, and it would allow us to cool the detectors very, very far down to around minus 20 degrees Celsius. And at that point, we could do a lot of testing of the electronics. The testing was not quite on schedule. So we were in a period called the Phase Zero upgrade. And that Phase Zero upgrade actually got pushed up. It got pushed up by about a year. So that meant that the entire schedule for the IBL also got pushed up. And we were a bit delayed, but the original schedule was designed that there was some flexibility to it.
Can you tell us about the incident in September?
I can tell you about the incident in September. So one of the things I learned when beginning to work on hardware is that you can't trust anything. And what I mean by that is you can't even trust your own safety system. So we had built this environmental chamber I mentioned before, and we built it with many safety mechanisms, doors that were latched closed in particular ways. We had redundant systems for measuring the humidity and the temperature inside of our system. But one of the things we have to do as a part of testing these silicon sensors is we have to cool them down. And the one thing you have to keep in mind is if you want to cool something down, you have to have very dry air around. Because if the air is not dry, if there's some humidity in the air, then you can have condensation, and that condensation can freeze. So one of the things we were very careful about is to have a lot of thermometers, a lot of temperature sensors, and a lot of humidity measurements to make sure we knew exactly what was going on inside of our environmentally controlled box. The thing that we didn't count on is that we had multiple failures. At one point, you can have multiple failures of these sensors in ways that you can't necessarily very obviously even see that they failed. So what ended up happening was one of our humidity sensors, it turns out, was broken. But the thing is, it would still give us back measurements. It just didn't give us back the right measurements. And even the most bizarre thing is when you were at room temperature, it gave you back the right answer. So there was something wrong with the calibration. And there was a latch that wasn't working properly, and so that probably allowed slightly more humid air in than would normally be allowed in. But again, this wouldn't have been a problem had our humidity sensors been working properly. They would have seen this immediately. What that means is, as we began to cool our environmentally controlled box, and we checked our humidity, the humidity seemed to look good, very low, But in fact, what was actually happening was the humidity measurement was wrong, and we were cooling it beyond the dew point. So condensation formed on two of our mechanical structures I mentioned before. So basically covering two of our pieces of the IBL with ice. We were trying to run these detectors. So you test them via a computer through a network, and we were trying to test them, and for the most part they looked pretty normal, but there was just a few measurements that just were not making sense. After months and months of testing these kinds of detectors, you get very used to seeing the kinds of things that go wrong. You see a signal that goes wrong and you almost immediately know what the problem was and how to fix it. But we saw some signals from our testing that just didn't look like anything we saw before. So we decided to warm up and open up our environmentally controlled box. And when we opened it up, then we saw the unfortunate business of all this ice having covered our detectors. I think we were pretty freaked out. We were extremely worried. These mechanical structures, we need about 14 of them for the IBL. And we had the ability to build about 20 of them. But what that means is there's not a huge amount of redundancy. So every piece that you lose, because these pieces were effectively lost now, every piece that you lose has a huge impact on your future of the IBL. It was really sad also because before this happened, these were two really, really well-working pieces of the detector. They were working fantastically. So we were very freaked out because not only have we just damaged, a lot of extremely expensive equipment, But we were also worried about the future, what impact this would have on the IBL.
So what was the community's response to these two frozen pieces?
It was varied. Of course, people weren't very happy about it. The funny thing is, the first thing you hear about when you're part of a detector that has problems and you speak to other physicists, as soon as you mention a problem, the first thing they say is, oh, I remember when this problem happened on this detector and when this other problem happened on this detector. It's very funny. Everybody seems to have these stories about the detectors they built and the things that went wrong. And some people were very worried about it. Some people were very angry about it. And I'd say a lot of the management was kind of very forward focused. Basically, we paused, worked on improving the redundancy of the safety of our system, and then getting started as quickly as possible. This was basically the focus as soon as this happened. Luckily, this was only, as I had mentioned, this is only 2 out of 20 pieces. So we still had, another 18 to go. And so we were still pretty sure that the IBL was safe. But there's always in the back of your mind, you realize like nothing can go wrong. Absolutely, no small problems. And all the rest of the pieces of electronics have to be perfect, which is something we couldn't control. So as I mentioned, the kind of the people in charge, of course, wanted to understand exactly what was the result of this ice. I mean, in some sense, it's from a scientific perspective, it was kind of an interesting phenomenon because, we never tested. You don't typically test your detectors under such strained conditions. And they wanted to know exactly what the resulting damage was on the detectors. And this turned out to be a very important thing that was done. So you might imagine if ice formed, it might cause some cracking or breaking of wire bonds or electronics. But actually what we ended up seeing a lot of was corrosion. A lot of the wire bonds seem to have kind of disintegrated away. So wire bonds are these small pieces of wire that just connect different pieces. So they connect this piece of silicon to our piece of electronics. And a lot of those pieces of wire had kind of disintegrated away. What we kind of discovered was there was some sort of element, something causing corrosion on these detectors. And we didn't know what it was. It could have been from many things. It could have been from something in the air inside of our environmentally controlled box. It could have been, something introduced, at many points. Or it could have been something that was kind of inside of the electronics themselves that only gets kind of washed around or moved around on the detector. Once you get water, this corrosion was something that we didn't expect to see. And the bizarre thing was when we went back and started looking at all the other detectors that didn't get frozen, we actually saw the signs of corrosion everywhere. This was kind of one of those moments where you kind of halt everything you're doing and you pause and you say, we're not moving forward until we understand this. And that's a big deal. So this was a huge concern because when these pieces of wire, they get weakened by corrosion, if they disintegrate, it means that certain signals in your electronics can't go through. I mean, imagine if you had a piece of electronics and someone took away the wire that connected the on-off button to the electronics. Suddenly you can't turn anything on or off. So this was something that had to be understood and fixed, basically, before we could complete the detector. The original plan was the detector would be finished testing by the end of 2013. But really, kind of the last deadline was the spring of 2014, because that's when, you know, at a certain point, you need to close up Atlas. In order to put the IBL in, we had to open up the center of the detector. And at a certain point, we have to put it back in and close everything up and basically connect all the wires. So actually, a task force was set up to investigate multiple things, including trying to understand what was the source of these chemicals causing the corrosion. And really, everybody, I mentioned that there was many people doing testing of all the different components as the IBL gets built. And all those people kind of came back together under this task force and would, you know, test each of the individual pieces to try to see where it was coming from. In the end, it seemed that there was some chemicals actually in the electronics themselves. In the fabrication process, there were certain chemicals that were introduced, and it turns out that if you introduce these pieces of electronics to water, you can actually pull those chemicals out of the electronics. But interestingly enough, if you never get them wet, as long as there's no condensation, no matter how humid it is, they will never start to corrode. So the end result was this task force understood where the chemicals were coming from and what could cause the corrosion. There unfortunately wasn't an easy way to remove all these chemicals, but there was an understanding of how to avoid any future corrosion. And so that everything was cleaned, all the electronics were cleaned, and actually we had to redo the wire bonding from most of these detectors. Thousands and thousands of wire bonds had to be redone. So a lot of those pieces had already been built, but every step of the production chain was kind of reinforced with extra caution about humidity. From our side, when we were doing the testing at CERN, we added a very brand new kind of, I guess you could say, very expensive, very high-end humidity sensor that we could connect with our cooling system, so we could easily turn on and off all the cooling based on these humidity monitors, and we could also do that in a controlled way. We added many new safety precautions about how, you know, what can happen with these latches and the doors. Kind of monitoring every single piece of our environmentally controlled box. And there was basically many redundancies that had to be checked along the way. If anything was noticed to be wrong anywhere in the system, the cooling would immediately turn off. That ensured that basically if anything looked wrong, that nothing was getting cold. And the last thing we did is we added a lot more dry air to the system. There was many kind of aspects to this task force of trying to understand not just what the source of this corrosion was, but what the repercussions might be. But there's only a finite amount of time we have to do these things. And of course, at a certain point, you have to build your detector. And then in order to complete this testing in time, because, you know, this task force, you know, it took some time to come to even basic understanding, then the kind of testing schedule got sped up, and the testing went from testing one piece of these electronics in a week to testing it in 2 to 3 days. We were working extremely long hours. We had to do these tests. We had to do a certain fixed set of tests. Every detector goes through the same set of tests, and that takes some finite amount of time. And then you have to worry about debugging, because not every detector works perfectly. Some of them work perfectly. Some of them have small features, let's say, that you have to figure out how to work with. And most of the time, you can. So everybody was definitely under a lot of stress, but at the same time, there was certainly a lot of support from the community to help us to get through what we needed to get through.
So, did you make it in time?
We did make it in time. When schedules get condensed, you begin to, you know, have to make time-sensitive decisions. So one thing you might have liked to have tested all 18 usable pieces of the IBL and then chosen the best 14. But because of the time schedule, we weren't quite able to do that. So what we had done is, you know, after we had tested a few, we begun, you know, out of the few pieces of the IBL that were tested, we would choose the best one of there and start kind of what's called integrating or mounting it onto the beam pipe. In the end, it was okay. We were able to test all the detectors and still choose 14 excellent pieces of the IBL and put them on. And yeah, it's looking, we made it in time.
Was it an enormous relief when you finished and you had a completely assembled and tested IBL?
Yes, it was an enormous relief. There was many enormous releases along the way of the IBL. The first was when we had tested our first detector after turning on this new environmentally controlled box for the first time, testing the first one and everything was okay was an enormous relief. Once we had finished testing 14 of them and we knew that there was at least enough detectors built that we could make the IBL, it was an enormous relief. But yes, the biggest relief was once all 14 of them had been put onto this detector, onto the beam pipe, and the system was kind of, in some sense, completed and out of our hands. After the detector was built and then it was installed and tested in the Atlas Cavern, I wasn't as involved. And I had kind of moved over to working on other projects in terms of data analysis. But I guess it must have been a couple months ago, suddenly I saw the first, it's called an event display. It's a display of, it's basically a cartoon image of our detector showing the what detectors had energy deposits in them, and then kind of traces, lines that show the trajectories of particles going through, which means that you were able to recognize the pattern of a particle. And so even before we have collisions, we can test our detectors using cosmic rays streaming down from the cosmos. And there was actually a very early event display, a picture showing a cosmic ray flying through the IBL, and the IBL having energy deposited on it, and the trajectory going right through, meaning that the detector was working properly, picking up the right signature, and contributing to the pattern recognition of particles, which is exactly what it's built for. And that was really the moment when I was like, okay, this whole system's really working all together. It's just really fantastic. I guess I'm most proud of the fact that the IBL, this small detector that had to be built on an accelerated timescale, was actually, I mean, it was completed and it was and it's working now. And that's not only a big step for this run of the LHC, where we have this extra detector that can provide us, you know, better technology for doing, you know, recognizing these particles, but it's actually a first step towards our next upgrade of the detector. Around 2025, the phase two upgrade. And that next step, there we're going to replace the entire pixel detector. And so it's very nice to see that we're able to make this first step towards that upgrade of a whole new detector.
So you're already looking ahead?
Already looking ahead, absolutely. And excited about building all new silicon detectors in the future.
Thank you for listening to In Particular.
We'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at inparticular@cern.ch.
You can find us at our website at cern.ch/inparticular.
Or on Twitter at Particle Podcast.
In Particular was produced by myself, Tova Holmes, Laura Gianti, and Zach Marshall, with sound and music production by Larry Lee.
We'd like to point out that the views expressed on today's podcast don't necessarily represent the Atlas collaboration as a whole.
But we would like to thank Atlas Outreach for their support.